Do you swear on the Constitution of the United States to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God?
This is Police Radio,
the voice of American law enforcement,
with your host, Randy Sutton.
Hello and welcome to Police Radio, the voice of American law enforcement. I'm your host, Randy Sutton. We have a great show for you today. We have a featured guest, Rob Michaels, who is the creator of Serve and Protect, which is an excellent therapeutic counseling resource for police officers who are suffering from PTSD. But before we get into the interview room, let's go to the briefing room where I give you my view from the blue, where we talk about all things law enforcement, current events, and whatever's going on in the world of law enforcement.
The briefing room, headlines, stories, and all that touches American law enforcement.
I want to talk about something that is really important in today's episode, and it may be somewhat controversial. It concerns Police Week. Police Week is a very special time for American law enforcement, and I have something very special that I want to say.
Hello, I'm Randy Sutton, a retired police lieutenant, the author of A Cop's Life, and the national spokesman for Blue Lives Matter. National Police Week is approaching. May 15th through May 21st is a sacred time for the men and women of law enforcement. It is the time when the lives sacrificed during the year are honored as their names are unveiled, carved into the granite of the police memorial. It's a somber time, a reflective time, filled with unbridled emotion. Thousands of law enforcement officers from not only across the United States, but from all over the world will converge on Washington, D.C. to show solidarity, respect, and honor for their brothers and sisters who gave their lives for their communities. Among them will be the families of the fallen, and their anguish will be a palpable fog of pain as tears of sorrow and loss soak into the hallowed ground. Wives, husbands, parents, and children will silently run their fingers over the names of their fallen loved ones, almost as if they were being granted one final touch. The events surrounding these days of honor will culminate one evening with a beautiful vigil within the center of the memorial, when the light of thousands of candles will reflect off of the proudly worn gleaming badges of the assembled company. Tears will unapologetically glide slowly down the faces of these men and women whose practiced stoicism will this night be surrendered. During these events, law enforcement and political leaders will be featured. They will speak of honor and of duty. They will talk about integrity and loss and sacrifice. Those chosen to speak will be people of prominence and influence, and their words will have power before this gathering if they are spoken from the heart. If they are not, if they are hollow and bereft of passion, then the words themselves, though mechanically correct, will be devoid of meaning and, in fact, insulting. It is for that reason that I publicly call for the banning of President Barack Obama from addressing this gathering of law enforcement officers, survivors, and supporters. I make this plea with a heart heavy with disappointment and the pain of betrayal. For I believe that our president has not only abandoned the men and women of law enforcement, but has actively pursued an agenda that purposefully undermined the American people's trust in those who sacrifice so much for the communities that they serve and protect. I'm not alone. Untold numbers of law enforcement officers feel as I do. So to allow him the opportunity, the honor of appearing before this gathering would be an affront to the survivors and law enforcement officers throughout the United States. I truly wish that I didn't feel this way. I wish that our president had used his great power to build a safer America, to forge bridges of unity between the people and their police, to break down barriers of distrust and create opportunities of unity and friendship, all of which are possible. But he chose a different path, and our country and its police are paying the price. 2016 has seen the murders of law enforcement officers rise by over 100%. Each day brings news of another shooting, a stabbing or violent attack. From the White House, there has been silence, and that silence speaks volumes. I can only hope that the next president of the United States, elected officials, and police leaders realize that the very fabric of our nation depends upon unity, the unity that comes from respect between the people and their police, the unity that can only be built when barriers of bias, prejudice, and distrust are torn down and open, meaningful relationships are rebuilt in their place. It can be done. It must be done. Our nation depends upon it. Okay, my friends, welcome to Police Radio, and we are going to take a walk into the interview room where I have a very special guest today. His name is Rob Michaels, and Rob is the CEO founder of Serve and Protect. It's a 501c3 nonprofit organization, and it's dedicated to serving the spiritual and emotional needs of those in public safety, criminal justice, and emergency services. He's based in Brentwood, Tennessee. But Serve and Protect provides 24/7 coast-to-coast crisis line, chaplain, and trauma therapist services for law enforcement, fire and rescue, EMS, dispatch, and corrections professionals and their families. They have a network of 3,500-plus chaplains across the United States and 15 countries, and four networks of trauma therapists from which they locate help for the men and women who serve in law enforcement. Rob, thanks so much for being here today.
Randy, it's a pleasure to be with you.
You know, you and I have had several conversations over the last few months about the situation facing law enforcement these days and how much more difficult it is and seems to be these days for our officers.
And,
you know, you've got an incredible organization. Most of the audience here are either law enforcement officers or people that support them. So give me a little description. Tell me a little bit about how you got into this work, and then we'll talk about the organization itself.
You know, Randy, it was a 41-year journey. It began in 1970 when I became an MP. And then 73 when I joined Norfolk Police Department and served both on patrol and in the Detective Bureau. In 78, I felt led to leave and go to Bible College, which I did for 4 years and got a degree. Went on to Wheaton College and got a master's degree in communications. Ended up here in the music business for about 30 years and was... became the chaplain in 2008 of our local FOP lodge, and in 2012, the state chaplain for the FOP. And it became very clear that there is a lot more need than the FOP or departments were providing for many reasons. One, because of an increased incident of post-traumatic stress, and also because most guys and gals are afraid to talk to employees' assistants.
Right, right.
They don't trust them. And so I was sitting in church one morning and knew that what I was doing was coming to an end because I could feel it. And prayed. And next thing you know, God put on my heart, start, serve, and protect. And what began with a focus on chaplains, we actually got to 5,000 chaplains.
Wow.
But it quickly, by building alliances, but you know, it quickly became apparent that the chaplain side of it was not where the calls were coming. The calls were coming for really to get trauma therapists, for people with post-traumatic stress. One key component is just a couple of months after launching and announcing it on LinkedIn, I got a call from a guy named Sean Riley. Now, I had wanted to have a crisis line, and I found one up in New Jersey. I called them and talked with them and said, here's my vision, and I want it to be nationwide. They said, well, we're only statewide, but if you can come up with $1 million, we can go nationwide.
Well, okay, that's nice.
I said, well, if I come up with $1 million, I don't need you. And so I got a call from Sean, and we share the same passion, and that is to help public safety professionals who are struggling with emotional wounds and addictions. And we formed a partnership. And essentially, what we do is when a call comes in, I promote his, I promote the crisis line, and it's a number that we have, 615-373-8000. When somebody calls, they have a choice to press 1 and it goes directly to Sean if they're in crisis. Or 2, it comes directly to me if they're looking for a trauma therapist or other resources. That's how we started. And that was 5 years ago, July 1st. And Randy, we've had about 2,500 calls since then.
That's a lot of people.
It is, but there are so many more that are hurting out there that you just wonder how many go unserved and look for every opportunity we can to get them the help that they need.
Well, let me ask you a couple questions. You say that you are the I'm gonna have Sean on as a guest as well at a later date. So let's just talk about Serve and Protect for the moment. When you say that you have the trauma counselors, explain exactly what they do and how it works. If I call your crisis line, how do I get help?
What happens is, a lot of people call Sean's line directly because he has several people, as do we, doing seminars around the country and handing out cards and information. So when they call into the crisis line, regardless of how they get there, what happens is we have peer advocates that answer the phone and assess their need. If it's addiction oriented or if it's something that's going to require residential care, suicidal ideations that are imminent, then Sean and his team goes to work immediately and facilitates that residential care. On the other hand, if they're wanting to talk to a therapist, if they say, you know, I can't sleep, I'm anxious, I keep having these recurring thoughts, or I get angry, or whatever the symptom that they present, it generally points to post-traumatic stress. Now, one important issue is addiction is not a symptom of post-traumatic stress. So those who call here may not have an addiction. And not all who have an addiction want to go to a residential care facility. So what happens is when they tell the call taker, the peer advocate, what's going on, then he'll ask for their phone number, email address, zip code, and their insurance carrier. And he'll send me an email with that information plus a brief description of what they're struggling with. Then I will look for a therapist in their area, in their zip code, that takes their insurance. And then I personally call and interview every therapist before we make a referral so that I can be assured that they understand the job that the caller has, that they understand the uniquenesses. It's funny, I'll have guys call in, and I use that term generically, but I'll have professionals call in and they'll say, have you ever heard of this before? And I'll say, man, you got to understand something. We ain't right. We weren't right the day we pinned on that badge and started running after bad guys or running into fires. So I'll talk with them a bit and help them understand what we're going to do. And then it normally takes 24 to 72 hours, depending on how quickly that therapist returns my phone call so that I can interview them. We've done it enough now that I'm starting to find therapist that I've already interviewed, so I just go ahead and make the referral. I was on vacation. I'm sitting here now with four requests in front of me. And that's what we do. Then we'll make that referral. One therapist said, so you're like Matchmaker or Match.com for police and firefighters, right? I said, that's a good description.
That's good, yeah.
But that's what we do. We don't charge a thing for what we do. We don't take a dime from any therapist or any organization to refer to them. We strictly work for the best solution for the problems that the caller presents to us. And sometimes it's trauma therapists. Sometimes it could be they've been through trauma therapy, but they're still struggling. So we can find equine therapy, which is a very good option. We can get service dogs for police and fire, which until about a year ago, that wasn't possible. That was very hard to find.
That's interesting.
And what we do in looking for a therapist, I filter it by looking for therapists that practice a trauma-based modality of treatment, EMDR, which is eye movement desensitization reprocessing, very effective. Rapid resolution therapy, that's a clinical form of hypnosis, which is extremely effective, and I've had very good results with that. There are more EMDR therapists, though, by far, than there are rapid resolution therapists. A couple of other modalities, brain spotting or somatic experience, some of those things are good. And I use those if I can't find one of the others. But I really focus on EMDR and rapid resolution because both of those are different than typical therapists. If one of our guys is going to sit down with a therapist and they start saying, well, tell me exactly what did you see? What were you feeling? What did it smell like? All that does is re-traumatize them. And we hear that from the people that call. EMDR and rapid resolution deal with what are they feeling right now? And they work to move the trauma that's bothering them. And it's, for our folks, it's cumulative. Now, you are a cop. I mean, it's not like you had one traumatic incident. You know, you saw a bunch of dead bodies. You went on a bunch of tough calls. Well, it adds up.
Right.
Now, some might stick out more than others. For me, there are two I'll never forget. One was just before I left the department. As I said, I was a detective. I was out headed to take a burglary report, and I pulled up on an accident. A Volkswagen was crushed against a telephone pole, and a guy was crawling out of a car, spinning on its roof. He was drunk. I walked over to the Volkswagen, and I heard that 18-year-old college student breathe her last breath. I didn't forget that. When I was a rookie, my FTO and I were cruising, and we pulled up on the scene. Somebody called in an accident. They had hit one of those large aluminum stanchions like you see on the internet. I mean, on the interstate. And brother, I'm going to tell you, there were six people in that car. Five of them had their heads laying back with broken necks. One girl survived. You don't forget those kinds of things. So what happens is, for some, a traumatic memory gets stuck in short-term memory.
Right, right.
You know, and it won't go away. So it triggers the amygdala, which is a fight or flight sense in your brain. It's about the size of a peanut, but it causes those emotional responses because for the amygdala, that memory is supposed to go to long-term memory, and it doesn't. Now, this is the layman's version of that because I'm not a therapist, but what happens is the amygdala keeps firing off fear or anxiety. It causes you to be sleepless. It might cause anger and rage. Now, if there's an addiction tied into that, the addiction is merely a means of self-medicating to stop that noise in the brain. They want it to go away.
Right.
Now, if they go to, what happens often is a department will say, well, you need to go see an addiction therapist. Well, if they're not trained in trauma, they'll treat the addiction. They'll get it under control. But unfortunately, 2-3 months later, It's back again because they didn't deal with the trauma.
Right.
That's
right.
The root cause.
Well, let me ask you this. You know, we you and I have had discussions about this in the past, but so many police officers are afraid to let their police departments know that they have an issue.
That's right. And
how do you keep the department, how do you keep this confidential?
Well, first of all, we have a HIPAA-compliant case management system that nobody has access but me. Secondly, we don't talk to any department. When that officer calls us, we deal directly with them. Now, some choose to use their insurance. Now, they may go in and say, I'm struggling with some anxiety. Well, the reality is it's PTSD. And what it depends on how it's recorded by the therapist as to whether it shows up on their insurance is post-traumatic stress. Now, legally, the department's not allowed to fire them for having post-traumatic stress. However, you and I both know stuff happens.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, we had a guy down in Florida that called Sean, and he got me involved. This was a guy, 16 years on the job, had been involved in a pretty big fight, and both of his shoulders needed to have some reconstructive surgery done. They put him on Oxy. Well, he got off of it, he got better, got into another fight, hurt one of the same shoulders. They put him back on Oxy. He went into employee's assistance and he goes, you know, it might be good for me to sit down with a therapist to make sure I don't get addicted. Mm-hmm. And the EAP, well, we can help you out there. They call the chief. The chief put him on administrative leave without pay 2 weeks before Christmas with six kids.
Jeez.
So we got involved. Sean got him into a center and activated the Federal Emergency Leave Act, the Family Leave Act, and they couldn't fire him. And we went to work with the FOP and local churches, and they helped him out financially. But we do what we need to help the issue at hand.
Yeah, but you know what you're telling me is that the unfortunate facts of this, that there is a minefield out there that police officers have to negotiate, and no matter how you try and cut it, there is still someone that has knowledge about the issue, and it can get back to the department.
Well, we do all that we can to maintain confidentiality.
Sure.
Now, I will not say that all departments would take action against them. Locally, our departments are very good about trying to find help for public safety. That's not the case in all manners. We had somebody call in that was actually part of a processional where the president was going through in West Palm, and a motor officer was run over by a pickup truck, and this officer got underneath there with his comrade and stayed with him until he died. That was tough.
Yeah.
Equally as tough was when the department said, well, you weren't there. Well, yeah, I was. No, you weren't. Well, fortunately, the president's photographer had a picture of it. And so they sent him to a therapist, and the first therapist said, yep, you've got post-traumatic stress. Well, that's not good enough. We need to go to another one, get a second opinion. Same thing. Yeah, you got post-traumatic stress. They sent him to a third one, and the guy goes, oh, you don't have post-traumatic stress. That's just part of the job. And you see, when I was on, and I'm sure when you first came on, post-traumatic stress wasn't a thing.
Right.
You know, it was just suck it up. The reality is things are beginning to move in the right direction. The state of Alaska state legislature has a bill before their Senate redefining post-traumatic stress from a disorder to an injury. An injury sustained in the line of duty. That changes everything.
Yes.
And, you know, when you've got people that they force out. I'll give you a good example, and I'm going to use his name because he posted it all over Facebook. His name's Byron. I'll leave his last name out. Byron was here in Tennessee, a deputy. He gets a call. A woman's calling in saying her husband's going to kill her. Well, it's out in the country. He gets out there. Closest backup was still 30 minutes away. He hears the woman screaming, "Help me, he's going to kill me." Byron runs in, kicks open the door. There's the husband with a gun pointed at the wife. He spins and shoots Byron twice, once in the shoulder, once in the groin. Byron returned fire and killed the guy, saved the woman's life. Governor of Tennessee gave him a medal, called him a hero. Well, as you can imagine, being shot in the upper chest and in the groin, it takes a while to get over, not to mention the trauma.
Of course.
His department wouldn't find him a light duty position. Randy, he actually got a letter from the sheriff of the department terminating his position because he hasn't been able to return to work because of injuries sustained in the line of duty.
That is absolutely outrageous.
Oh, well, somebody, wink, wink, called the local investigative reporter. And you see, like I said, I was in the music business. I was a PR guy, pretty good at it. And I made a phone call, and they interviewed that sheriff. And they showed him a copy of the letter that was sent to me by Byron. And they, oh, no, no, we didn't. You know what? That was an error. You bet it was.
Incredible. So,
they hired him back.
Yeah, until the next time, right?
Right. But you see, it really depends on the department.
Of course.
It depends on. But why guys are afraid to say anything, Randy, is for two reasons. One, they're afraid that if they're sent to an addiction therapist who sends them to a psychiatrist and they put them on pills, they'll be told they're not fit for duty.
Right.
Secondly, if they say to one of their buddies, and you know, peer support has its place, but the problem is when people are facing serious things, they're having physical altercations with their wife, they're struggling with suicidal thoughts. I mean, Randy, the numbers are against us. 85% of first responders have some symptoms of post-traumatic stress. Now, I'm going to tell you it's 100% because one thing that isn't listed as a symptom is emotional desensitization. Think back to that first trauma you ever saw. It shocked you. The next one, not so much. The third one, it's no big deal. Well, that's because emotionally you're becoming desensitized to violence, to carnage. Well, what that does, I call a cast iron shield. It builds it up, and it makes it to where you don't emotionally respond like others do. Well, that's what leads to the next statistic. 75% of police and 87% of firefighters are divorced at least one time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you go from work to home and it's been a bad day and you've got that cast iron shield and your wife says, "Hey, listen, the toilet stopped up. I need you to go up and fix it." Well, that doesn't hit you right. Well, she doesn't understand what's going on, but we change. We become something different. Sadly, 40% of our officers, at least the last survey that was done, are involved in domestic violence. The research hasn't been done for a while. I hope it's better, but we don't know. And when you talk to organizations that I won't name, that you and I both know, that should be doing something about this, whether they work with administrators or whether they are a fraternal organization, and you and I both know what I mean, they talk about doing something but don't do something.
Right. Well, at the end of the day, though, you know, the officers themselves are the ones that will benefit from the assistance that you can provide.
Oh, absolutely.
And so, you know, sometimes there's a chance that you have to take in order to get your mental and emotional health back.
See, that's why they need to call us, because we're not going to talk to their department. I mean, Randy, I had one guy call me 2:00 on a Saturday morning. "Rob, I'm either going to eat my gun or come to Jesus." Another guy called. I've been trying to get him to go see a therapist. Rob, I can't take anymore. I'm on the way to get a gun and kill myself. Randy, I wouldn't shut up. I kept talking to him. And finally he goes, all right. Talk to my wife for a few minutes. He went home. And, you know, I sent you an email, a page about a girl named Jenny. Her husband committed suicide locally. And the department called and had me come down and do a debriefing. Well, here comes Jenny walking in. He said, would you talk to his wife? Girl had on skin-tight jeans, motorcycle boots unbuckled, a motorcycle jacket, and a pink mohawk.
Okay.
And she sat down across from me and said, yeah. And what was hiding beneath that ironclad exterior mm-hmm. was a heart of gold that was broken.
Right.
For 3 years, we talked. She would call me drunk from the grave of her husband where she was ready to kill herself. And one of the biggest fallacies about suicide is, well, nobody will care. They'll be better off without me. Families are destroyed when suicide happens. It's a fact. So we help people from all over the country. Most recently, I helped somebody in Brussels, Belgium. One of our chaplains got a hold of me and said, can you find somebody in Brussels? And I did. We use every resource we can find to locate the proper therapist.
Well, it sounds like you're doing a hell of a job. How many people do you think you've helped in the last 5 years?
Well, about 2,500. Now, that 2,500 that have called in for help, most of them came through Safe Call Now, some through Facebook, some through email, some directly from departments. Listen, in fact, I was just on vacation. I got a message from a chief not far from here, a fire chief, that said, you know, when you get back, give me a call because we've got about 12 or 13 people that could use your help.
Yeah, I think that agencies are beginning to come to terms with post-traumatic stress issues and becoming a little more cognizant that there is help out there and these people need and should be treated with respect and dignity and given the help that they require.
Well, think of it this way. Would you rather throw away a 16-year veteran and hire a new rookie or take a couple of months, rehab that veteran that is suffering because of the job you put him in, or deal for the next 2-3 years training that rookie to become half the officer that you already had?
Right. Yeah, of course. Of course.
And it's cheaper to keep our guys out there on the streets. You know, we're seeing some bad things. Politically, our guys are getting hammered and they're not getting the backing that they need politically.
I agree 100%. Have you seen an increase in calls since the madness of Ferguson?
Well, people talk about the craziness of what's going on and being afraid that somebody's going to come after them. Randy, there was a police officer in Birmingham that got involved in a fight and was afraid to pull his gun. Somebody pulled it for him and beat him in the head. We had, if you remember, probably 6-8 weeks ago, we had a week where 7 guys got killed in 7 days.
Oh, yes, I remember quite well.
5 of those guys were killed in 1 day.
Yeah.
One of those guys responded to a call of a man with a gun at a playground. He got there and pulled his taser.
Yeah.
Well, he lost on that one because our guys are afraid to take action because they're afraid they're going to be on YouTube or Facebook or Twitter. You know,
my question is, are you finding that because of this, there is a higher incidence of calls coming in because of these issues?
They don't directly say that, but what I can say is that this year our calls are up about 20%.
Well, that's pretty significant. Yeah,
it is. And for me, what I want people to understand is we will find you help, and we'll find you the best help available.
Okay, let's talk about how these police personnel and law enforcement officers can find you.
Well, there are a couple of ways. One, we are on Facebook at facebook.com/serveprotect. Website is serveprotect.org. And my email is rob@serveprotect.org. And my phone number is 615-373-8000. And they can choose to either contact our crisis line or come to me directly.
Well, I think this is a service that, I mean, I really commend your dedication, you know, to go from police officer to, you know, recognizing the psychological, emotional dangers facing your brothers and sisters, educating yourself and creating an organization that's touched the lives of so many people. You know, you
want to be commended. One thing that's important, one critical point is I have a top secret clearance. I'm a chaplain for the FBI. It does not matter whether you're state, local, or federal. I can talk with you, and I can keep you confidential.
Okay, that's probably one of the most important aspects of this entire conversation. You know, Rob, thanks so much for being on Police Radio, the voice of American law enforcement, and I'm sure that the people that are listening to this right now know either are feeling effects themselves or know someone that has been... that has experienced these type of issues.
And, absolutely.
Let's hope we can get them some help. Thanks again for appearing, and we will talk very soon.
Thanks, Randy.
This is Police Story, the real stories from those behind the badge.
Today's segment on Police Story is written by a police officer who active duty who wishes to remain anonymous, and there's a lot of reasons for that. And here at Police Radio, the voice of American law enforcement, we honor those requests. Remember, if you have a police story, you can send it to me, Randy Sutton, at AmericaOutloud.com. Here's your story. It's called My Worst Call. People, when they find out you're a cop, always seem to ask the most inappropriate questions. They don't mean anything by it. They're just curious. I'm a 10-year veteran of a mid-sized Central California Police Department. We have about 80 to 90 sworn officers. A few years back, I went through a divorce. The mother of my son is also a cop with a different agency. Our marriage, like so many others, was failing. My boy was 4 at the time. I was standing around the local Starbucks in the morning after briefing, as we do on occasion, with the guys. It was a foggy, as anyone familiar with Central California's truly fog knows. It was a February morning. One of the guys had just got done telling a story involving a child. And I remarked, you know, thankfully, I haven't had a really bad kid call since my son's been born. Sure enough, seems like the second that passed my lips, dispatch comes over the air. Code blue, 5-week-old at 123 XYZ Street. I ran to my car with my beat partner running to his. He was a fairly new officer and not from the city we work in. As I was screaming down the freeway in the thick fog, I could only think to myself, please let me get there in time. My partner, due to the fog and inexperience, missed the off-ramp. I made the turn and ended up first on the scene at the apartments. This is a huge, lower-income apartment complex. Somehow I went right to the apartment. I ran up the stairs two at a time and found a small boy laying on the floor with his family huddled around him. They were all panicking and shouting. I physically pushed them out of the way and dropped down, picking up the tiny child in my arms, checked for breathing and a pulse. Nothing. I notified dispatch I was working a code to tell EMS and fire to hurry up and began CPR. Now, this is not the first time I've done CPR on a child. Some officers I've talked to have gone entire careers without having done CPR on anyone. Not me. While many cops seem to trip over gangsters and guns, I get the code blues, the 5150s, anything out of the ordinary. I'm right around the corner. I'm giving the requisite numbers of breaths and chest compressions, and the only thing I can think is the last time I was holding a child this small, it was my son. Fire got there very fast, but to me it seemed like a lifetime. I had already walked down the stairs and out into the street with the child, doing CPR the whole time. So when fire and EMS arrived, I practically threw the child into the paramedic's arms. Now, I have been shot at, I've been in high-speed car chases, I've had my nose broken and seen some shit, but I was shaking with adrenaline like I'd never shook before. It was so intense. My beat partner finally showed up. He'd had to go down to the next off-ramp a few miles down and double back. He saw the look on my face, and I could see how upset he was that he missed that off-ramp. It wasn't his fault, and I don't blame him at all. My sergeant saw I was upset and sent me to my car. I got on the phone. I called my boy. I held it together for my quick little chat with him and then completely lost it in my marked police car, bawling. That little boy didn't make it. I pulled myself together and went back to take the report. That was a terrible day. A few months later, I was sitting in my car minding my own business when I got a call of, yeah, you guessed it, code blue, 4-year-old found in a pool. I shit you not, I was 2 blocks away. I screamed code 3 down the street, pull up to a screeching halt on the lawn of the house where panicked family was shouting into the phone and jumping up and down at me. I ran from the car, shouted for someone to tell me where the child was, and ran into the house full speed. I was directed into the backyard and found a female ineffectively pushing on a chubby little boy's chest. He was wearing swim shorts and no shirt and was soaking wet. I dropped to my knees and began CPR. Of course, I didn't grab the CPR mask they give you, so I'm doing CPR. The child is regurgitating pool water and vomit right into my mouth. So in between rescue breaths, I'm spitting off to the side, thankfully not vomiting myself. The family is standing around me all shouting. I don't know what they're saying. I can't hear them. All I can focus on is this little boy, same age as my son, lying lifeless on the deck of the swimming pool. Fire and EMS got there again. Someone had to shove me out of the way. I've been on my knees for so long, I couldn't feel them or even get up on my own. They worked on the boy and transported him to the hospital. I stumbled back to my car after briefing the officer, who was thankfully going to take the report, and I drove off. I barely found a quiet spot, one of my hidey holes, before I broke down. You see, in addition to the impending end of my marriage and the last CPR incident I just had a few months ago, today was Father's Day. That boy also didn't make it. I never really gave a shit about the reasons. That was for some other officer or detective to deal with. There was nothing I could do. I felt cursed. I made it through the next year. Divorce was finalized. Funny thing is, my boy's mom and I get along better than we ever have now. We meet for a family dinner once a week. The three of us, sometimes with her boyfriend, and we talk. I've talked to counselors, not because I was crazy or suicidal or anything, but because you have to get that shit off your chest. You have to say it out loud to someone you can trust and who won't judge you, or it will eat you alive. I never tell these stories to people. It's too heavy for nice, normal folks. They certainly didn't ask for a story like that. They just wanted to hear something cool, like driving fast or tackling someone. The stuff you see on Cops before they cut to commercial. That is the story for the people I trust. The people that know me. My worst call.
End of watch.
This is End of Watch, where we memorialize police officers who have lost their lives in the line of duty. 35 police officers, as of this week, have lost their lives. serving the people of their communities. This week, on May 1st, Sergeant Jorge Ramos of the Florida Department of Corrections died while he was on duty. He had a heart attack. On May 5th, during a vehicle pursuit, Investigator Anthony T.J. Freeman of the Bibb County Sheriff's Office in Georgia lost his life. And on May 9th, just 3 days ago, Detective Brad Lancaster of the Kansas City Police Department was murdered in the line of duty by gunfire. This is your end of watch.